Pull up a chair, I want to tell you about the man who invented wing walking. Not because he wanted fame, but because a radiator cap came loose at 3,000 feet and somebody had to fix it. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Tonight we're going back to the years right after the First World War, when the sky over America was filling up with surplus airplanes, out-of-work pilots, and an audience of farmers and small-town folks who had never in their lives seen anything fly except birds. The barnstorming era, and nobody lived it harder or died for it more completely than Ormer Leslie Locklear. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now to understand Ormer Locklear. You have to understand what the end of the First World War looked like from the cockpit side of things. The armistice came in November of 1918. The United States Army had spent the war training thousands of young men to fly. They built airfields across the country. They ordered airplane after airplane. They built up an aviation infrastructure from essentially nothing. And then, almost overnight, they didn't need it anymore. The government auctioned off its surplus Curtiss JN4 Jennies for prices that seem almost criminal today, $1,200, sometimes less. A Jenny in 1919 cost about what a decent used car cost, and the pilots who had trained on them, who had given years of their lives to learning the sky, found themselves standing in civilian clothes with no job, no obvious future, and a set of skills the peacetime world had very little use for.
What do you do with that?
You go barnstorming. The word itself tells the whole story. You'd fly out to farm country, pick out a flat field near a barn, land without asking permission half the time, and put up hand-painted signs in town. Come see the flying machine rides. $5, stunts free, and the people came. They always came, because in 1919, most of rural America had never seen an airplane except as a speck in the sky. If that, these barnstormers were bringing the future right down to earth, landing it in somebody's hayfield, and letting you touch it. The Jenny was the perfect airplane for this. Not because it was fast. It wasn't about 75 miles per hour flat out. Not because it was powerful. The Curtiss Ox-5 engine putting out 90 horsepower was reliable, only by the standards of the day, which is to say it quit on you regularly. But the Jenny was forgiving. It was slow enough to watch from the ground, and it was everywhere, thousands of them. You could find parts at any military surplus auction in the country. The barnstormers figured out pretty quickly that a straight flying demonstration wasn't enough. You needed a hook. You needed something that made people stop and point and grab the person next to them. Loop-the-loops helped. Spins helped, but the thing that really stopped traffic, the thing that had farm wives covering their mouths and children screaming, was when somebody climbed out of the cockpit and stood on the wing. Ormer Locklear didn't invent that trick to impress anyone. He did it because the airplane was broken. Locklear was born in Greenville, Texas, in 1891. If you'd met him as a kid, you'd have known exactly what kind of man he was going to become. The neighborhood kids used to watch him walk along rooftop ridges the way other boys walked along fence rails. He thought heights were interesting rather than frightening. He was a carpenter and a builder before the war, a man comfortable with his body in space, with the physics of balance and weight and motion. He enlisted in the Army Signal Corps when America entered the war and ended up as a flight instructor at Barron Field, near Fort Worth, Texas. He was good at it, patient, precise, with the kind of instinct for an airplane that you cannot teach. And it was there, probably sometime in 1918, that Ormer Locklear did something nobody had done before. The exact details vary depending on who's telling the story, but the substance of it holds up. He was airborne in a Jenny when something went wrong, a radiator cap, a fuel cap. Some accounts say one thing, some say another. What they all agree on is that the problem was up front on the aircraft, reachable from outside the cockpit but not from within it, and that Locklear made a decision. He throttled back. He trimmed the airplane, and then he climbed out. He worked his way forward along the fuselage, the slipstream pressing against him at somewhere around 60 miles per hour, the ground a long way below, the engine noise filling his ears. He fixed whatever needed fixing, and then he climbed back in. Now here's where it gets interesting, because when Locklear landed and told people what he'd done, their reaction wasn't horror, it was wonder. And Locklear being Locklear, he started thinking about what else might be possible out there on the wing. He began practicing. He refined techniques. He brought in a partner, a pilot named Skeets Elliott, who would fly the Jenny while Locklear worked the outside of it. By the time the war ended and they found themselves out of uniform, they had something nobody else had. They had a whole vocabulary of stunts that had never been performed before. Ormer Locklear's barnstorming act was unlike anything the public had ever seen. He would start with the basics, hanging from the landing gear by his hands, standing on the top wing with arms spread, the jenny going level at 1,000 feet while he balanced there like a man in a park on a pleasant Sunday. Then he'd raise the stakes. He perfected the mid-air plane transfer. Skeets would fly the jenny low and slow over a second airplane piloted by a third member of the team. Locklear would hang from the undercarriage of the upper aircraft, and at the right moment, drop onto the upper wing of the airplane below. Not a landing. A transfer. One moving aircraft to another moving aircraft, with nothing between him and the ground but air and timing and complete mastery of his own fear. Audiences didn't know how to process what they were seeing. This was 1919. The Wright brothers had only flown 16 years earlier. The idea that a man could be airborne in an airplane was still new enough to be astonishing. The idea that a man could be airborne outside of an airplane, climbing around on it, jumping between them, that was from another universe entirely. The crowds grew, the money got better, and Hollywood came calling. By 1919, the film industry had figured out that aviation made for spectacular pictures. The war films had used aerial footage whenever they could get it. Now the studios wanted more. They wanted stories built around flying, and they needed pilots who could do things on camera that would make audiences lean forward in their seats. Locklear signed with Universal Pictures. His first film was called The Great Air Robbery, released in 1919. It's a silent picture, and you can find pieces of it if you look hard enough. What you see when you watch it is footage that should not exist. Locklear transferring between aircraft, hanging in open sky, the camera struggling to keep up with him, no special effects, no safety cables, no net, just Ormer Locklear at altitude, doing what he did. The film was a success. The studio wanted more. The second film was called The Skywayman, and it was The Skywayman that killed him. It was August 2, 1920. They were shooting a night sequence over the Dominguez Hills outside of Los Angeles. The script called for Locklear to be seen in his airplane at night, so the production had rigged up a series of powerful arc lights on the ground, the kind they used to light outdoor sets. The idea was to illuminate Locklear's jenny from below as he flew over, visible against the dark sky. What nobody had fully worked out was what those lights would do to Locklear's night vision. He was in a spin when it went wrong. Some accounts say it was a planned spin, part of the scene. Some say he lost control. What the witnesses on the ground agreed on was that the airplane came out of the spin too low, at an angle that had no recovery, and went in near the lights at high speed. Ormer Locklear was 29 years old. Skeets Elliott, in the cockpit that night, died with him. The barnstorming era didn't end there. It went on through most of the 1920s, growing in some ways, getting regulated in others. The Air Commerce Act of 1926 gave the federal government authority over aviation for the first time, and some of the wildest stunts started disappearing as licensing and safety rules arrived. But Locklear is the one who defined what barnstorming looked like at its peak. He's the reason wing walking became a standard part of the American air circus vocabulary. Every flying circus act that came after him, every barnstormer who climbed out onto a wing to get a crowd on its feet, was doing something Locklear had pioneered. He invented a tradition. There's something else worth thinking about. The barnstormers didn't just entertain people. They sold aviation to a country that didn't quite believe in it yet. Every farmer who paid $5 for a ride in a jenny went home with a story. Every kid who stood in a hayfield watching Ormer Locklear walk on a wing grew up with aviation as something real, something possible, something that could be touched. The people who became airline passengers in the 1930s, who accepted commercial flying as ordinary and sensible, a lot of them had their first encounter with airplanes at a barnstorming show in a field somewhere. The barnstormers were the advance team for everything that came after. Locklear left no autobiography. He didn't live long enough. What survives is the footage, fragments of two films that look like they were shot on another planet, and the records of people who were there who watched him work. One of the newspaper accounts from his performing days described the crowd going completely silent when he climbed out onto the wing. Not because they were bored, because they'd stopped breathing. That's the effect he had. I pulled most of this from the Aviation History Archives and from research by aviation historian Dan Hagedorn, who documented the early barnstorming era thoroughly. More at radiohanger.com for Ormer Locklear, 29 years old. He got every bit of living into the time he had. See you next time.